I want to begin confessionally today. Confessionally in the sense that we were away, as I mentioned, Barbara and I, we went to the Festival of Homiletics in Minneapolis. First time I'd been to Minneapolis, lovely city. Didn't see a whole lot of it, but lovely, whatever I saw. And it was an incredibly moving, enriching, inspiring conference indeed. Almost 2,200 preachers gathered together. The singing was awesome. The quality of presentations and sermons and workshops, just all together wonderful indeed. But I want to focus on one question. I was serving as a conference host this year. And on the very last day, on Friday, a gentleman came up to me and he said to me, "What do you know about God now that you didn't when you arrived here on Monday?" And I thought, wow, that's a deep question. That's a deep question. I pondered that, didn't quite give him an answer, but I thought of this particular text that has been going over and over in my mind all week and was even addressed by a couple of the speakers in a tangential way. And I realized something. I realized that I do not question my fervor, my commitment, my desire to be a faithful servant of God. I do not question my desire, my fervor to help us as a congregation grow into deeper faithfulness and following in the way of God. But what I realized that that question prodded within me and challenged me to see is that sometimes in my efforts to minister and to preach, maybe too often, I don't know, I haven't figured it out yet, I take more responsibility upon myself than is mine to take. I try to do too much of the work that belongs to God. When I try to help the congregation understand the text and the implications of that text for our faith and for our ministry and for our work and for our blessing of the world, I think I realize that I take too much of the responsibility and the weight of that undertaking upon myself. I'll let you know when I figure that all out, but that occurred to me after this week and after pondering that question, that perhaps what I need to be doing is to understand how to be invitational, how to be more invitational. It doesn't mean that I am not meant to challenge, that I am not meant to pose questions, I'm not meant to comfort, but it seems to me that God is in the middle of these texts that we name are living and breathing. And it also means that God is here, present, and God's Spirit is doing more than I can do. So what is my role in all of this? So I want to begin that way. I want to begin by saying I'm learning some things about myself. This week, this conference, this reflection, that question. And so I'm going to try that today. I'm going to try to invite us into this text that Jesus offers us today from Matthew. Remember the way in which it's framed. It is framed as part of the conversation and part of the preaching that Jesus is undertaking on the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is addressing primarily his disciples, those gathered there, not only the 12, but others who have joined the movement, others whose hearts and imaginations and lives have been captured by the invitation to follow me. So he's addressing it to them. There are crowds who have come who are overhearing what he is saying to them. Because what he is addressing to them assumes a relationship with God. It assumes that somehow they are already on the way towards giving their lives away to this way that Jesus is introducing, this way of God's reign. And that's an important concept, an important framing for us to realize. And so Jesus begins this particular portion of our text today by making a very challenging statement. He says, no one can serve two masters. Now we know in our own day and generation today, we try and serve a whole lot of masters, don't we? We call it multitasking. Demands on our time, demands on our allegiance, demands. We are pulled in so many directions. We try to do what Jesus says you can't do. And look where we are. I'm guilty. Guilty as charged myself. You can't serve two masters. But here he is conceptualizing it in terms of ultimate allegiance. You cannot serve God and what is called mammon. Now, mammon is more than just money and wealth. It is all of the activity that is entailed in pursuing it, in seeking it, in securing it, in investing it, in doing all those things that if you give yourself utterly and totally and primarily to that, you are going to be left with little energy, perspective, imagination for anything else. You know what I'm talking about, right? The more you have, the more you want. The more you have, the more you want to secure, you want to protect, you want to stave off the forces of volatile market, of thievery, of all kinds. You want to put your energy into that. That becomes the most important thing. And God said, you can't do both. There you have it, either or. No middle ground. We like the middle ground in some areas of life, but God said, no. Sorry. Either you're going to hate one and love the other, or you're going to be devoted to one and despise the other. I remember in Jamaica, some of you wouldn't know this, I was serving in the inner city of Kingston, Jamaica, and making a strong appeal to the broader populace, if you will, especially within the church, about the need to attend to the urgent situation within the inner city. And I remember I was preaching at a fairly well-to-do church. They'd invited me to come and talk about what was going on in the inner city, what our common responsibilities, the implications of our faith are. And after the service, and I thought it was, maybe I was too much in the way in that sermon too, I'm not sure, but it was a very poignant, sharp, but hopefully loving and graciously offered sermon. And a gentleman came up who was the owner of several large companies within Jamaica, and he had taken out his checkbook and had written a check for the work that we were doing in the inner city. But he said, more than this, he said, I don't want you to focus on this. And he took me aside outside, nice oleander, I remember a plant was nearby, and he said, I hate you, but with a smile on his face. I hate you for disturbing my neatly packaged way of living. I hate you for undermining the security I had built up and the rationale and justification for my pursuit of my money and wealth and position. Because now you have forced me to think about my faith and my money and my life and my priorities in different ways. So I just want to tell you that. Maybe people will come and shake your hand and say, I love you. Remember me. I hate you. Thank you. And he walked away. Either you will love the one and hate the other, he says. And then he goes on to say, because Jesus wants his disciples to understand, as he does us, what does it look like when we put our trust in God? What does that look like? What are the implications? What is the significance? What is the benefit for you and me and for the world when this happens? And in order for people to be able to figure that out, they've got to see it alive and well and working and performing. They've got to see it. It's hard to imagine because our lives are consumed with activity and contests for what is most important. And so Jesus says to them, remember, this is an important thing to remember. He is addressing primarily his band of disciples because the things he says make little sense if you have not already given not only thought, but resolve and commitment to trusting, to growing in your trust of God. It makes no sense. Do not be anxious about your life, what you shall wear, what you shall eat, the shelter, all of that. Don't be anxious. For your Father knows you have need of this. Don't worry. Well, let's stop right there. before we go any further, let's stop right there. I know I'm not the only one who worries. Right? Any worriers here? Maybe you're all so saintly and just Jesus has got your ear and you're just, but I worry. And I began thinking this week about what is it that I worry about? Well, some of them are trivial. Some of them go to the core of myself, my ego. How do I appear in front of people? Some of them have to do with my children, with our children. I worry that our children might not find suitable and loving and respectful life partners. I worry about that. I worry about big things too. I worry about the people in China and Burma and Myanmar and Darfur. I worry about them getting what they need and the justice that they require. I worry about the fact that Jesus says, don't worry. And I worry, and how does that fit together? I don't worry so much about food. I like food. Don't worry a whole lot about what to wear, about shelter. I give thanks for that. But I do worry about other things. And then I began to realize that this text only begins to make sense if we recognize what Jesus is trying to say. Remember, let's go back to how we framed it before. It has to do with what is of ultimate importance to us. Where are we investing our lives and our meaning and our security? If we do so in God, then Jesus is saying, don't worry that this one whom you have invested in will abandon you, will not take care of you, will not provide what is needed, what is necessary. And so the things that he mentions have several levels of meaning. In the first century context that Jesus is addressing, what you eat, what you wear, and what you drink, so to speak, was not only necessary for everyday life, but there were also symbols of your station in life. So if you wore flowing robes and ornate jewelry and purple and so forth, it meant what? That you were wealthy and important. If you could eat the most sumptuous of meals instead of the staples that the majority of the peasants ate, it meant that you were flowing in abundance, usually at the expense of so many others. If you lived in palatial places, then people had either on the street or little tents or rudimentary houses. See, so there are double implications for not work. Don't worry about moving up the success ladder. The basic things God will provide for you. God's not going to give you a mansion, maybe, but the basic things will be there. All that you need will be available to you if you trust this God. Here's the other thing that bothered me about this text. You expect, as the rhythm of the text progresses, that things are going to turn out well. Don't you like things to turn out well? You like happy endings. And this is one of the things sometimes that frustrates me about Jesus. I feel set up. Notice how the text goes. Don't worry. Your Father in heaven knows what you need. Look at the birds. That word is very, very strong. Consider the birds of the air. In other words, learn, see what you can learn from them. Study them. They have a carefree life. They find what they need. They're provided for. The lilies of the field. Now, they don't work or toil or spin, but lilies do something. They incline themselves to the sun and they draw nourishment and succulents from the earth through their roots. They strive. So, yes, strive in life. Thrive and strive and learn about being carefree in the sense of trusting God. Hey, things are looking pretty good now, right? Okay, keep going. For your Father knows you have need of the things and will provide. So seek first the kingdom of God and all these things with you. So all I have to do is be a good Christian and follow along and all these things, this carefree life and so on is going to be great. You see where we are? And then verse 34. Why did you have to go and include verse 34? So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry for itself. For today, but remember what he said, the last thing in that phrase? For today has sufficient trouble of its own. Why did you have to go and spoil it? It looked like it was going to turn out good, and then here we are, Jesus saying, trust God, live in faith, follow God, seek the kingdom, and all these things will be yours. And don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be okay because you have enough trouble today. Well, I thought you said don't worry. And it seemed to me as if Jesus is saying, you want to be a fair-weathered follower only when things are good? Learn how to trust God when the troubles of the day are upon you. And you and I have had those kind of days. We've had the days where we've come home, we are frustrated because of a loss of our temper, unkind words to fellow workers, to neighbors, to family members. We have driven a little bit more crazy than usual on the road. We have had people hurt us, betray us, damage us, insult us. We've had the kind of days we'd rather just forget, and we come home and we don't feel very much like a follower of Jesus on those days. And yet Jesus is saying it is on those days, like every day, that this God who loves and cares for you, trusts you, loves you, and cares for you. You do not have to perform at a certain level in order to gain the favor of God. Listen to what the prophet says in Isaiah 49. What is it that God says to the people of Israel coming out of exile, just in the midst of their most tortuous life? Their day's trouble was perilous, was hurtful, was painful. What does he say? I have helped you. Hear the prophet. I, says God, have answered you. Can a mother forget a nursing infant? God is depicted as a mother who will not forget her nursing infant. Now, you and I know that every metaphor has a yes and a no. So, yes, mostly we think, but we know there are some who do. Is that not true? There are some mothers who do not treat their children as they ought to. So that metaphor has a yes and a no. But here's what the prophet goes on to say. Though they may, I will not forget you. And here's an incredible metaphor of how God is trying to communicate to you and to me how much he will stand behind his word to love and to invite us into a trusting relationship. The text go in the Hebrew word, it says, I will mark you on my palm. But the Hebrew word is something that is really very famous now today all over the place. God says, I will tattoo your name on the palms of my hand, and I will not forget you. I will not forget you. So Jesus' words and the prophet's words form a bookend of an invitation to trust. Do not worry. And do not worry doesn't mean that we don't have the natural. It'll be like Jesus saying, don't have feelings. We all are going to worry. Do not be consumed by those things that we worry about. Actually, the word there for worry is more akin to fear. Fear and worry are cousins, first cousins. And we are reminded, fear not, fear not. Why? Because we're called to seek first, the first things first, seek first the kingdom of God, God's reign. That's what the choir sang to us. That's what the choir sang. Thy will be done on earth as it is in. Seek ye first the kingdom, the reign of God. Let that which God desires to be evident in the world come here now. When that happens, what are the things of God? What is God's righteousness? Justice, compassion, forgiveness, love, sufficient for all? If we begin to live unencumbered lives of overstress and overworry, we will be freed up to seek those things. And if we sought the justice, and if we sought the peace, and if we sought the compassion, the forgiveness, all of those things of God, what would the world look like? Would there be leaders preventing aid from getting into their citizens? Would there be Arab and black African in conflict in Darfur in a genocide? What would happen if there were thousands and thousands and millions of people who trusted God, who lived their lives unencumbered by the worrying about all the petty stuff that we get consumed about, not having enough, not in the latest styles, not trying to secure our lives with all these things? What if there were more people who were trusting and seeking after the righteousness of God, those things that make for a better world? Oh, just imagine. Just imagine. And so here's the invitation that is made. You and you and you and you and you and I have our names tattooed on the hands of God. This God who, like a mother, cannot forget the infant at her breast. This is a God who anticipates our cry in the night before we cry. This is God who knows what bothers us, what hurts us, what oppresses us. This is a God who says, here, come and trust me. Shift your priorities and all will be yours and all will be well. It's just our definition of all will be different. All the things that God prizes as valuable for you and me and for this world will be yours. First things first. Do you see your name? Picture your name. God sees it every time. God looks at his hands. See your name? Don't worry. Trust God. Amen.